Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 260 of Allied Strategies. My name is Tristan, joined as always by my friend Benjamin.
Hello.
And my friend Sam.
Hello.
Hello. This week we are returning from the 2020 season grand finals. Benjamin, how was your tournament?
It was extremely mediocre. I went 6-6, a perfect 50% record.
A perfect 50% record against some of the top players in the world.
That is true, and if we'll all recall, I put myself somewhere in the bottom third, so I feel like I overperformed my expectations, although I didn't quite reach my aspirations.
Yeah.
It's good. Set the bar very low for yourself, and then expect better for yourself, I guess. Or hope for better.
Well, I'd hoped for better.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we can get more into it a little bit later, but basically, like, I didn't really feel like I was at a significant... I had no edge in the tournament whatsoever, neither in play skill nor in deck selection. And so I was pretty much just hoping to get luckier than my opponents. I was pretty happy with the way I played overall, except for one critical mistake. But, I think that I didn't, I didn't get luckier than my opponents, so, or at least not enough luckier. So,
You were in a unique position in this tournament.
Was I?
Of all the players, you were the only one where all your possible opponents were world-class competitors.
Oof.
Wow.
That's not even true. Wow, we've been over this. I'm in the middle of the pack.
Well. Anyways, since then we've had some cards removed from existence, really. Omnath hit with the Ion Cannon in all formats. Followed by actually... in all arena formats. Although notably not banned, of course. Only suspended in Historic, so... And it's not banned in all formats. You just can't play with it. We also have a bunch of other changes, though. Particularly, I think there was some surprise in Standard to see Escape from the Wilds. Or Escape to the Wild? Escape to the Wilds. Also on the ban list. What did you guys make of that one?
I was somewhat surprised, but not particularly disappointed. I think one of the big issues that's come up in Standard is that the removal is actually pretty good, but the removal is not worth playing because people had access to so much card advantage and ways to just fill right back up that it was, you know, like people would play an Omnath or whatever and you would have to remove it because you lose the game if you don't. It gains like 4 life a turn or sometimes 8 if they're, you know, if they're playing fetches or whatever, and generates a bunch of mana and just does all this stuff. But then if your plan is to like use 1-for-1 removal, they just go so far over the top of you with cards like Escape to the Wilds and Genesis Ultimatum. But in the case, I guess, of the Clover deck, they didn't even need Genesis Ultimatum. They just used Clover and Escape to generate all these extra cards and really make it so that like trying to strategically trade with your opponent's creatures and maybe make some of the rest of them less effective, you know, because you're good at blocking or whatever, was just not a strategy that was worthwhile. So I think getting rid of Escape helps push us a little closer to the world where that is worthwhile. And I actually kind of think Standard might be in a good place now. I don't want to put too much confidence behind that because I'm really not confident in it, but I could imagine Standard being good now, whereas before I really couldn't. So I'm cautiously optimistic.
I'm pretty optimistic as well. I think they've managed to finally hit all the cards that like give you absurd plan Bs, basically. Like now, whatever the best deck is, I think you can attack that. Whereas I don't really think that like the Omnath Clover deck was really attackable. Like there's no card that you could put in your sideboard really that was good against Omnath Adventures.
So the card that I think might end up breaking what you just said, Ben, is Yorion.
Yeah, I mean, Yorion is still really powerful, but Yorion has been like pretty within the bounds of acceptable ever since the companion nerf. Like, it's been around every standard, but It's kind of
I guess I was more speaking to playing three or four or whatever, probably just three Yorians in your main deck. And like one of my big issues with Yorians is sort of the unearned wins that it has sometimes, where they like just play some permanents that do stuff in the first couple turns and then blink them all with Yorian and the game is over. And you're like, well, I didn't want to disenchant your Omen of the Forge, and I didn't want to disenchant your Omen of the Sea, but now I just lost because you played a 5-mana 4/5 that draws 3 cards and kills a creature.
I do think that Oath of Kaya and Jace rotating out has hit Yorian rather hard.
Jace? You mean Teferi?
Oh, sorry, Teferi.
Yeah, that could definitely be. That's just the card that's sort of next on my radar as most likely to cause that. I'm not sure that it actually will.
Yeah, I see what you mean. I will say, like, you know, people often point to Embercleave as being, like, the next busted card or whatever. But Embercleave strategies, like, there are lots of ways to attack them.
It's so clear as well.
To change your deck to make it good against the Embercleave card. I'm not really too worried about... I'm not stressing over, like, Standard needing another ban these days.
That kind of card with just a natural, obvious counterplay, you know, kill their creatures, it's so much harder for that to warp a metagame to the point that, like, you're aware it's the best deck, you build a deck to defeat it, and you go, you know, 45% against it and you're in the tournament or whatever, and you're just like, oh... What have I done? Why am I like this?
Yeah, if you compare this to cards like Uro or Lucky Clover, where you just don't... Like, you could try to interact with the card itself, but doing that is such a losing proposition when they don't draw it, or they don't draw it at exactly the right time. Like, playing artifact removal in your deck against adventures is like... You know, if they just don't draw Clover, it's just such a big disadvantage to have that card in your hand. Like, those types of effects aren't really going to... I don't see them happening as much in Standard anymore.
Yeah, especially because Embercleave, like, does not require you to actually interact with Embercleave itself to mitigate the advantage that the card brings. Like, if you are expecting a bunch of Embercleave and just play Stomps, you'll probably be okay.
In addition to the Standard bannings, we also have some historic changes. Unsurprisingly, Omnath suspended there as well. Teferi and Wilderness Reclamation upgraded to banned, so they are they're gone for good. Burning Tree Emissary unsuspended as well, so that's an event as well. That's what's happened in Historic. It's so weird to me, reading these Historic notes, I always have like a... Like, when I saw Teferi Time Raveler's banned, I was like, oh, dude, that probably made the format so much better. But it's like that you couldn't play it. It was suspended, right? It's just like, I don't know, it's so weird that they have this interim phase.
I definitely agree. When I read that announcement, I got very confused as to why I didn't try playing Teferi in my Historic decks.
Yeah, my reaction was like, didn't that already happen? I thought, because I never for a second thought it was going to get unsuspended.
Right.
I didn't think that was at all likely to happen. So it didn't surprise, you know, it felt like the other thing had already occurred, although I guess it technically hadn't.
I feel like maybe, I don't know, maybe it's a flaw with the suspended or unsuspended thing, or maybe it's simply... just a little nitpick with the way that they do the ban restricted announcement, where they could just like is upgraded from suspended to banned could be the line of text there instead, and so that we don't have that that reaction.
I think they could do with a little more skipping straight through the suspended step to banned, like.
Right, you only suspend the cards like Omnath, for instance. Like, is anybody really expecting Omnath to get unsuspended in 6 months?
No, I think there's basically 0% that will happen. Whereas Burning Tree Emissary, I think, was a good example for one to suspend. See if that made things better or worse. But like, yeah, Wilderness Reclamation, Omnath, no one expects these cards to be back.
Yeah, I think you're right. Like a kind of suspended, you know, 10% of cards that would get banned get suspended instead or whatever, 20%, some relatively low percentage. To like indicate that it's experimental, but I feel like it's not too experimental with many of the cards recently that have been suspended in Historic. I saw something interesting. I think Frank Carson tweeted that now over the past, I think, 15 months, there have been more bannings in Standard than in the entire previous history of the format.
Yes, kind I believe of, that is true.
Kind of a wild time to be alive. Because if you'd asked me 15 months ago whether Standard had, you know, been healthy recently, I would have been like, no, dude, there's been so many bannings. And since then, it's been ratcheted up to 11.
I think it's sort of like a paradigm shift with how their department is even thinking about bans. Like, it used to be that a ban was a huge deal and that they would try really, really, really hard not to do it because they believed it significantly damaged consumer confidence. I have a feeling they now have data that shows that bannings are just not really that damaging to consumer confidence, even though it seems to me that that data is probably fairly difficult to collect. And so now they're just like taking a much more hands-on approach.
Yeah, I wonder to what extent that's because of like Arena being the, you know, the place they're moving to, like much of their revenue is coming from that now, right? And so like it's not like your physical cards have become worthless, it's just your digital cards. You get some wild cards back or whatever, so it's less of a hit to people when their cards get banned.
I wonder how much revenue they make from Arena. It'd be interesting to know. Yeah. I wonder if those kinds of things... I've like never really attended an earnings call ever in my life. I wonder if those sorts of things are like publicized in an earnings call. Probably not, right? It's probably just like total revenue.
I think they say how much like Magic is making. I don't know if they subdivide it further in those. Anyways, I have no idea what the answer is to that. I was just making stuff up, so it could certainly be either way. All right, so that's the Standard, Historic, and Brawl. Of course, Omnath banned in Brawl as well, so that's big news there. That's what's happening. That's what's happened to our formats. This week, our main topic is is not the bans, although that was kind of going to be part of our main topic, but I accidentally just kind of opened with it. So you know what? This week we're starting this in medias res. That's a literary term for when you begin your book in the middle or whatever. That's what they did in the Odyssey. That's how that book started. So that's what our podcast is doing today as well.
I would like to share an anecdote with our listeners.
Okay.
So before we do the podcast, every time we come up, we write up our show notes. We're like, okay, this is what we're going to do. Like, you know, this is like the introduction. This is the card of the week. This is the main topic, whatever. So for this particular week, you know, we do this and we create this thing, and we have a specific thing written here as an introduction, which Tristan hasn't even gotten to yet. He just starts talking about, you know, the season grand finals.
I didn't talk about the season grand finals except for just like, how did you do? But like, it's so standard for if there's been a big tournament and if there's been a banning, so just talk about it at the start, despite the fact that, yeah, maybe that was supposed to be our main topic a little bit this week.
Oh, finish my story. So I've written a sentence, a question for Tristan in the show notes.
I was tabbed out of those.
Introduction, by the way, while he's for like the last 15 minutes.
I was tabbed out. Dude, I was reading I was tabbed into the banned and restricted announcement, not into this page, obviously.
I think we should experiment with even more extreme structural shifts. Like, what if we put the end story first and then intersperse the patrons at random throughout the episode such that we were just saying their names like in the middle of sentences? Do you think people would be into that?
we have to preserve the order though, because the ordering is important.
Yes, of course, of course.
I believe they would be into it probably exactly once. I don't know. I just remember that time we filibustered the episode and there were a few people that were not happy with that one.
I'm not trying to make each episode everyone's favorite episode. I just want it to be someone's favorite episode.
Yeah.
Wow.
I want to elicit a strong emotional reaction from the listener.
And if we have to ban the episode in a week's time, so be it. That's the price of exciting design.
Exactly. We got to take risks. Be bold.
So
now we can finally transition from our main topic to our introduction.
Yes.
And Sam can give us a little update on Shacklegeist.
Yeah, so I don't remember what our exact conditions of our discussion were before, because we certainly wouldn't have wagered on it. I'm positive of that.
We would never wager on a tournament or a portion of a tournament.
But we had had a discussion where I said that I thought Shacklegeist was going to be very good in Modern Spirits, and I think you were a little less high on it.
I said that Nebelgast Herald was a better card, and you said that Shacklegeist was a better card. And we argued about how many of each would be included.
Okay, yeah. I just wanted to give you a quick update on what I think is now stock spirits. There were some Pioneer PTQ. There's a Pioneer PTQ this weekend that I played in, and that Spirits ended up doing well in. It won a Pioneer Challenge. And it looks like the current way that people are breaking down their mix of spirits is 2 Shacklegeists, 2 Nebelgast Herald.
Oh, so they caught up. So now it's even.
So now it's a dead heat for now, you know, as things have evolved a little more. I don't
know
how
that's the trend direction here. Which one had more representation last time we checked in?
Nebelgast had more.
Yeah. Okay. It was more Nebelgast than Shacklegeist. So, you know, just saying that's the direction we're headed. Going long, I would certainly bet on Shacklegeist. Like, 2s are just going to be, you're going to want more of them than 3s for the most part. So I expect that to keep pace.
We'll see.
All right, very cool.
Certainly, if they print a lord that grants vigilance or whatever, then you're definitely right. But
yeah, that seems in bounds, right? Like a white spirit lord that grants
it's
vigilance.
It's certainly plausible. Like, they'll run out of designs eventually.
Yeah, wasn't there already a white spirit vigilance anthem?
There's a glorious anthem that gives vigilance.
Okay.
Yeah, there's also that.
Always watching. The creepiest anthem that's ever been done, I think, if you look at the
art. Yeah, I was thinking of Intangible Virtue, which is tokens. Yeah.
Tristan, did you know that they cannot print a 2/2 first strike flying for 1 white?
Well, of course, Benjamin. That's a restricted list card.
Yeah, that's Thunder Spirit. It's on the reserve list.
Thunder, a notably white element. in Modern Magic. Yeah, love it. Okay, dude, do you know there's a card Teleport, right? That it already exists from I was listening to Drive to Work at some point, hearing Mark Rosewater talk about how these kind of cards from the old days are like their bane, or just like a cool card that could be a cool design, and it's just like Teleport already exists. It's a 3 mana triple blue combat trick that you can only cast during Declare Attackers to make target creature unblockable this turn. And so
yeah,
it's
really tough because Legends the set was like, I believe, just top downed to the people who were making its D&D group. That's like where a lot of the creature names came from and stuff like that. And also, I think where a lot of the spell names came from, like Anti-Magic Aura. And I'm sure when they're designing, they're doing a Forgotten Realms core set, right?
I think.
Yeah, I'm sure they are really bummed that space has been, like, mined to the extent that it has.
It's not even been, like, you know, thoroughly mined well, though. It's like they're just, like, randomly, like, 20% of the space has just been used with complete garbage.
I think they hit a lot of the, like, really iconic D&D spells. They missed Magic Missile, so they're going to get that one, and I'm sure they're really excited for that. I think that's a really big win for them, but the, like, all of the really iconic D&D spells, I think, do have cards at this point.
Yeah. What caused me to have that thought? I don't remember. Anyways. Let's move on.
Great segue.
The rest of our show. Thank you. Thank you, Benjamin.
We're only like 30 minutes in. It's definitely time to talk about the patrons.
Dude, we're not even 30 minutes in. We're 20 minutes in. Our supporters. Who's counting? The people counting may be some of our most avid fans, and some of our even moster avid fans may be patrons of our show, such as illustrious friends of the podcast, Kiki Jiki, Kyle, Jecha MT, Baptiste, Baptiste Jr., Bobby, and Luke. The good friends of the podcast are Adam, Zach, Britton, Kyle, Caroline, Eric, Sam, Duncan, Wilson, Tobias, Paul,
Jarvis, Kitty, you,
Boucher Therapy, Greg, Hot Soup, Ari, Rob, Matthew, Brent, Moosh's Bot,
Winchester,
Asher, Dan, Dunn, Alex, and Will. Thanks for all your support. Dude, I feel like Winchester is getting a really, really good deal out of this whole thing. The enthusiasm per dollar ratio as a good friend is just remarkable.
Yeah,
I'm
definitely better than Jarvis. My
enthusiasm.
Every week I'm just like, Jarvis, you.
We also have a Patreon question this week, which of course is a segment that is kind of an optional segment, but if patrons have questions, we answer them when they come in. There's usually not more than one in the queue, but if there is, we just queue them up. This week comes from TJ, who asks, how do you think the pandemic will impact the long-term play split between in-person and online magic? Also, do you find yourself enjoying or preferring different decks now that online is the main option for playing these days? Arena automates so much and changes the speed of play in such a way that I find myself wanting to play different decks on Arena versus what I used to enjoy playing in person.
So for the first part of the question, it is really hard for me to evaluate how I think the pandemic will like long-term change how we play paper Magic. Like I could imagine a huge range of different outcomes there. It doesn't seem implausible to me that like the paper Pro Tour just never comes back. That doesn't sound out like, I hope that doesn't happen, but that doesn't sound impossible. And I really don't know what is going to go on there. As for me, what I play, I already played the majority of my Magic on digital clients before this. Like I would go to Grand Prix and Pro Tours, and that was it. Those were the only paper Magic that was the only paper Magic I played, and I mostly tested for those online. So it hasn't really impacted that for me very much. But I will say, I think that the Arena economy and just online play in general has created a world where the best decks get played at a much higher rate than they would at like FNM or other paper Magic, which is almost certainly contributed to people getting as sick of them as they have, as quickly as they have, just because that is Omnath costs the same as some other mythic rare from the set, and it's a lot easier to acquire all the cards you need to play the best deck. So there's not as much like, oh, you know, it's week one, I don't have the new cards for this deck, but my friend has these ones, so I'm going to play this or whatever.
It's also just like, I don't know, so many games need to be played before you can really be super sick of a lot of formats, right? Like, even if Omnath is but what I'm trying to say is, in person, if you wanted to play 100 matches of Standard in person as kind of like a normal person who doesn't, you know, playtest with a team or whatever in a draft camp or something like that, that would be something that would take many weeks at the earliest. Like if you were able to play 100 matches of Standard in person, just like with in-store gameplay over the course of a month, that would be a month where you played a lot of Magic generally. But doing that online on Arena, you could do that in a week and it would be reasonable, right? Like playing a couple matches or playing 10 matches a day of Magic on Arena is trivial to do, right? In the 4 hours that you would need to like drive to and then play while you're waiting for these rounds of a Standard night at your LCS and then or LGS and then drive back, like you could play 10 matches on Arena pretty easily in that time. So I feel like that is it means that these formats are artificially, like, you know, something that would take 3 months to develop in before, I feel like you could be sick of it in a week now.
Yeah, it's also a little difficult for me to disentangle the formats being what I would say are bad for the most part. Like, I've mostly thought that Magic has declined since the pandemic. Like, the sets released have really messed things up. And that has definitely impacted my desire to play. So I've probably played less because of that.
Do either of you have a response to the second part of this question about, does it change which types of decks you might want to play digitally versus in person?
I don't really think so. I don't know. I feel like I prefer just a certain style of gameplay. And then that style is sort of independent of how long the particular match takes or how long it takes me to perform certain actions. I guess decks that involve a lot of shuffling are a lot more tolerable on Arena. I will say that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas Wilderness Reclamation stop based decks are a lot less tolerable.
Yeah, I was willing to play Jund Food on Arena and like many click combo decks on Modo already, so it hasn't really changed my bar there. The one spot where I think I actually become more likely to play a deck is more controlling decks on Arena and Magic Online, like Lantern Control, for example. I would never play in paper. I just don't like having to tell my opponents to play faster. The one tournament that I played Mono Blue Prison at, I really had a miserable time because my opponent, like, the games just took too long. And on Modo, I really don't have to worry about that because the chess clock means that I'm never going to time out. So I'm much more willing to play that style of deck.
Yeah, the digital format actually is definitely an interesting one. And you know what? To continue the theme from earlier, let's just do another bit of the main topic now before we get to Card of the Week. So, because this is a good segue. One thing that happened to the 2020 season Grand Finals was a little bit of an intentional draw-related, you know, snafu, I would say. Or it was brought back up again. It was in the limelight because into the top eight, the match that was on coverage ended up being intentionally drawn, and it, you know, turned out that the Magic that had been on stream for 20 minutes or whatever had been irrelevant, and in fact the two players had been, you know, emoting at each other or whatever and being weird, so because it had been a fake game that they knew and the spectators didn't, and that brewed up again this discussion of, are intentional draws something that should continue to exist in tournament Magic, particularly as we go digital? In a digital environment, the core need to have a draw at all coded into the rules no longer exists, right? Because in a paper tournament, you have a 50-minute round. What do you do when 50 minutes is up and a match isn't over, right? You either implement some kind of draconian sudden death rule that really changes and perverts some incentives for the players, or you just have a system whereby draws can exist. And there's been some discussion about making draws as bad as losses to discourage, you know, slow play and remove intentional draws that way. But that has a lot of innocent bystanders maybe that get taken down as well along the way, or maybe
it just
not
doesn't
so
remove
innocent slow players.
It just doesn't remove the collusion issue.
Right.
Because two people get into a draw, all of a sudden they're incentivized to figure out one person to concede. So, like, it doesn't actually stop the collusion from happening.
Yes, that's true. Whereas on a digital setting, there's no need for that, right? You have chess clocks, so you can guarantee that a round will end at a certain time with a decisive result in each match, right? And have it not be an issue. So that removal of the need for it has then caused people to be like, all right, you know, is this more harm than good, right? Do we need to have an intentional draw exist any further in the tournament? Sam, what's your take on this?
I knew going into the tournament that intentional draws were allowed, and I, in fact, because I'm friends with Matt Nass, who was, you know, on a testing team with Nassif and Levy, I knew that they were Hello? That they had been discussing whether or not they were going to draw. Like I knew that before the round or whatever that was a possibility. I think it doesn't make a lot of sense for these digital tournaments to have draws. I don't know what the correct solution for paper Magic is, but all of the solutions that I've seen proposed have a bunch of competing trade-offs that where maybe it's good, maybe it's bad. It's hard to say. For Arena, it seems to me like it's a no-brainer that there's no real need for it. There's not a lot of upside, in particular with the structure that this tournament had, where players, once they were locked for the top eight, were just removed from the tournament. So there wouldn't even be the awkward collusion-y spots where, you know, I make top eight, I'm guaranteed, and then I get paired against a friend or whatever. It's just not going to happen.
That was a great change, I think.
Yeah, I liked that change, having watched it. I think there are some costs to it. Like, I thought it was really cool when players popped off and they didn't get to do that this time, but...
Right, like 12-0 player or whatever?
Yeah, I thought that was cool from previous Worlds. But I think that happens infrequently enough that this is a worthwhile change for these sort of small field tournaments.
Yeah, you definitely will get people like conceding their friends in if you
right, and particularly dream crushing people they don't know, or that when their friends are other, you know, will be benefited by that dream crush, right? Which is like, it makes it so that in these tournaments, the percentage of the field that is your friend is a very valuable statistic to raise, right?
It's just good to remove the opportunities to collude from people because, like, they, you know, helping out your friend to get a top 8 is totally reasonable thing for people to do.
Right, so rather than trying to enforce a rule against it, you just remove the incentive and or the ability to do it.
The ability,
It's
better.
Yeah, the one thing I will say is that I am actually not particularly sympathetic to the sort of coverage concerns over all other concerns for the tournament. Like, I think that tournaments should first and foremost be fun to play in, because I think Magic is more fun to play than it is to watch. So my preference is that tournaments are created that are fun to play in as opposed to fun to watch. You know, if ever a decision comes up that is trying to balance those two things, I understand that's not necessarily the reality, but that being said, I don't really think intentional draws add any particular fun to a tournament. So sure. I think trying to remove them is fine.
I would say they add negative fun.
In this particular...
Like a very particular kind of individual who really loves doing tiebreaker math to figure out if they can draw or not.
Yeah, tournament math is a wild one. In this particular case, it seems to me like there's at least one clear, strictly better answer for all players, which would be to just like, even if you weren't going to get rid of drawing, you require players to, you know, submit that and not play games in a match which they are submitting an intentional draw for, right? Like, that way you can avoid this thing of having coverage for a match that was drawn.
I feel like, so one thing about this that I think there's some misconception about is, like, I feel like people think the players who draw are, like, you know, cackling at how they've managed to cheat their way into the top 8 or whatever. But, like, we really just treat it like a strategic decision, and people often, like, really hate it. Like, Magic players, like, especially people who do it for money, like, you know, are incentivized to try to maximize the amount of money they have, and that includes trying to figure out, like, whether to play or draw is a strategic decision. And, like, every time this comes up, like, everyone is always like, oh, my God, all right. I have to figure out if I have to draw or not, or, like, I have to figure out if I'm supposed to draw or not.
Particularly in this case, right, because there were 3 top 8 spots and 4 players intentionally drew into them, right?
Yeah.
So one person was out of luck.
Nobody, like, enjoys figuring out if they're supposed to draw. Okay, I shouldn't say nobody, but, like, very few people, like, maybe Andrew Ellenbogen, very few people enjoy trying to figure out if they can draw. And so I think, especially on Arena, where we've just removed a lot of the reasons that draws exist in the first place, just axe them. There's something to be said for having tournaments run by more or less the same rules and have the same options available to everyone. But I think the fact that this just keeps coming up and people keep complaining about intentional draws, like, just get rid of them already. They don't really serve a lot of purpose.
Yeah, I do think the strongest argument in favor of them existing on Arena is we want the game to function the same as it does on paper. I believe that is the strongest argument. I don't believe it is strong enough to keep the draws, though. I think they should go.
People have such a strong visceral reaction. Some people have such a strong visceral reaction against draws, which I don't really understand. But, like, I don't know, if they really feel like it harms the legitimacy of Magic that much, then I think we can just get rid of them for digital tournaments. Yeah. I don't think it harms the legitimacy of Magic. Like, people play a bunch of games to get into a position to draw in the first place. Like, I don't think it's unearned in any sense of the word. Like,
right. I mean, having 8 wins and 3 losses versus 8 wins and 4 losses the next round is a better position, and it's reasonable to reward that by letting them draw into 8-3-1 or whatever.
So, I don't think there's anything inherently, like, evil or wrong with intentional draws, but I do think that, like, they're just a pain, and if they're not providing a service, then you should just get rid of them.
Yeah, and one thing that I think draws do that is actually a good thing is create a different kind of tiebreaker that I think is slightly, or at least I'm willing to talk myself into being slightly more meritorious than the actual tiebreakers that happen in a tournament. Like, for example, I played in a Magic Online PTQ this weekend where 8-2 went from 6th place to, I believe, 27th place. And I think it is better if the players who are 8-1 going into the last round make top 8 as opposed to the, you know, because they can draw, as opposed to the players who are 7-2 and then win and get luckier on tiebreakers. I think that's a slightly more satisfying experience overall and a little bit more fun. It's not like a huge deal or anything, but, you know, given that we have to use tiebreakers in some spots, I do find it pretty annoying when the discrepancy, like when records stretch over such a wide range of different outcomes.
I think that's unavoidable though. Like that's going to happen regardless of if you allow draws or not. I mean, if you allow draws between the people who are 8-1, then all of a sudden, you know, 8-2 is still like, you know, 8th place versus 29th or whatever.
Yeah, I think it just happens later.
In the most recent tournament, we literally had a case where there was intentional draws and still tiebreakers determined whether you made top 8 or not, right? In the 2020 season grand finals.
That happens all the time. Like nothing you can do is going to get... Just because of how the cuts to a fixed number of players work, like, you're never going to be able to get rid of that.
I believe that making tiebreakers more predictable and feel a little bit less arbitrary is a reasonable goal as well to go for Tournament Magic. I've proposed this before, but changing it from opponent match win percentage, which is not necessarily, you know, there's merit to that, of course, and a strength of opponents is perhaps a reasonable way to break ties. But it can feel arbitrary and, you know, unpredictable, right? Whereas changing it to something like when you got your first loss, right, is also has some merit.
In a Magic tournament before, by the way.
Yes, and I think this is when I last brought it up, but it should just be the tiebreaker. If I lost in round 7 and you lost in round 6 first, then you should have the tiebreaker over me. And if we both lost in round 6, then I lost in 12 and you lost in 11, then you should also just have the tiebreaker over me. And it's not necessarily but it's not like opponent match win is a perfect proxy for strength of opponents as well, right? Both whether you, like, the longer you stayed undefeated, the stronger your opponents were on average as well. And in this particular case, it's entirely predictable as well, right? You don't have to do this this sweat of tiebreaks in the same way where, you know your the strength of your tiebreakers and it doesn't change as much randomly or pseudo-randomly. So that's my little bit. I don't think it's a big deal, though.
I just feel as Magic players, we all get used to variance, and there's variance in all things, including tiebreakers.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean,
for yourself up to the tiebreaker gods.
yeah, you do. I mean, the only PC I've ever played was due to incredible tiebreaker fortune along the way, so can't discount that. Let's move on to our Card of the Week segment. After a record, I believe, of 40 minutes of show, we've made it to Card of the Week.
I didn't realize we hadn't done Card of the Week yet. I legitimately thought we had done it.
Well,
Benjamin, what's your Card of the Week?
My Card of the Week is Elspeth Conquers Death. Elspeth Conquers Death is a saga for 3 white. When it enters the battlefield, exile target non-land permanent and opponent controls with converted mana cost 3 or greater. That's chapter 1. Chapter 2 is until your next turn, instance and source, actually probably non-creature spells your opponents play cost 2 more. And then the last chapter is return a creature or planeswalker from your graveyard to the battlefield, put a +1/+1 counter or a loyalty counter on that permanent. And I don't know, I think Elspeth Conquers Death, you know, it's been a bit of a downtick. Like, it hasn't seen much play recently, but I think it might be time for ECD to rise again. A lot of people playing the Great Henge, a lot of people playing, like, a lot of mid-range green creatures. And I think, actually, Skyclave Apparition is a really good card to get back with Elspeth Conquers Death. So that's kind of the space I'm looking at in Standard right now. I played a little bit with, like, those cards in my deck yesterday. Did a little bit of climbing the ladder for funsies. Fun Magic, first time I've played it in quite some time, but, you know, we've complained about this card as being kind of harsh on on non-land permanents of high CMC, but I think now that Teferi and Narset have rotated, it might have reached like a more fair state where you can't get Planeswalkers back as easily. And now, you know, I'm just going to be bringing back Skyclave Apparitions and keep exiling my opponent's stuff until they die.
Wow, you get Skyclave Apparition for the little stuff, and
yeah,
and stuff, for the big stuff. It really, really fits an A and B.
Sam, what is your card of the week?
My card of the week is Neoform, which is a blue and a green for a sorcery that says, as an additional cost to cast this spell, sacrifice a creature. And then it says, search your library for a creature with converted mana cost equal to 1 plus the sacrificed creature's converted mana cost. Put that card on the battlefield with an additional +1/+1 counter on it, and then shuffle your library. And this card showed up in sort of two different spots that I thought were both exciting this weekend. The first of which was a handful of players played the Neoform combo in Pioneer, or in Historic, excuse me, which was that you play a Seagate Stormcaller, which will copy your next cheap spell that you play. Then you play Neoform, so it gets copied, and then you find a bunch of, what's that guy called? Dualcaster Mage, and keep copying the Neoform that's still on the stack. And lastly, find some Glasspool Mimics to copy that. And then lastly, you find Tuk-Tuk Rabble Fort, and they all have haste, and you attack for a bunch. I thought that deck was pretty neat. It didn't look particularly good to me. It seemed like a lot of people were playing really good hate cards against it, like Yasharn was in a lot of main decks, and it looked pretty tough for the Neoform deck to beat. But I thought that was a cool combo deck. And then the other spot it showed up was in Pioneer. It actually won the Pioneer PTQ in a 80-card non-Yorian deck.
Excuse
that
me?
Is not playing any lands. It's only playing flip card lands. So that's how it makes mana. And its goal is to get either a Balustrade Spy or a Undercity Informer into play. And Balustrade, they both basically, for 4 mana total, Balustrade Spy costs 4 and is a summon ability. Undercity Informer costs 3 and has 1 sack a creature, but it can sack itself. To mill a player until they hit a land, you mill your whole deck, which triggers a bunch of triggers a whole bunch of Creeping Chills, which triggers your Silver Smote Ghouls, which trigger your Prized Amalgams. So you deal them 12, gain 12, put, you know, 30 power or whatever into play between all the zombies, and you use World Spineworm so you don't end up decking yourself, because you do put your whole graveyard into your whole library into your graveyard. And the cool innovation in this deck was both being 80 cards, because it has, I think the reason it did that is because it has cards that are bad to draw in it. Like, you don't want to draw the Creeping Chills, you don't want to draw the Prized Amalgams, you don't want to draw the Silver Smote Ghouls. And then it also used Neoform and Eldritch Evolution as a little package to go with a bunch of 2-mana creatures. So like Sylvan Caryatid, Tangled Florahedron, and Paradise Druid, and you could Neoform into Balustrade Spy or Undercity Informer, I guess into Undercity Informer because they cost 2, to get your milling going, to mill yourself a bunch. So I thought that was a really cool and innovative deck that looks really interesting to me. I don't know how good it is. It did win the PTQ, so that's pretty cool. And yeah, it doesn't play Yorian just because it doesn't have the mana base to support it. It's basically playing all basics or all lands to tap for a single color because it can't actually play any real lands. So it didn't have a ton of blue sources aside from its mana creatures. So it makes sense to me to not actually put Yorian in this deck.
Right. Yorian is just the only cost would be the sideboard slot, and that wasn't worth it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense.
And some amount of signaling to your opponent what you're up to, although I guess now that people know 80 cards know Yorian, that's a pretty strong signal as well.
I feel like you gain a signaling benefit by having Yorian in your sideboard.
Yeah, that's true. It might be correct now.
Well, I mean, even before, you know, if your opponent is prepared for a Yorian deck, they're probably not going to counter your Sylvan Caryatid, but they would if they knew what you're up to, right?
I think once you play the two, like, once you play, like, a Vastwood Fortification or whatever as a land, they probably will figure out that you're on a, like, no land, all spell land kind
Maybe,
of thing.
Maybe, yeah.
Can this deck beat a Wrath of God?
No, maybe not. I don't remember exactly how it all works.
Well,
can
okay.
you like, set it up so that the prized amalgams come into play on your opponent's end step somehow?
Oh, that is right. That is how it works. Yes, the prized amalgams come into play on your opponent's end step.
Because the silver smote ghouls come into play on your end step.
Correct.
I see.
Yeah, it intentionally plays zero narcomoebas for that reason. It also plays haunted dead, which is a way to beat those cards.
Okay.
You can get all your amalgams back.
Well, so couldn't you go through the loop two more times as well if you really get wrathed?
No, because all your creepy chills are gone, so your way to get Silver Smoke Ghoul is gone.
Okay, so your way to get everything is gone. I see.
But you have Haunted Dead, so you can still get the prized amalgams, and that's how you still win.
I see. Very cool.
Well, having them come into play on your opponent's end step is pretty powerful.
Yeah.
All right, my card of the week is Pelucranos, World Eater. Pelucranos World Eater is 2GG for a 5/5 legendary Hydra from Theros the first time, with XX green monstrosity X, and when it becomes monstrous, it deals X damage divided as you choose among any number of target creatures your opponents control. Each of those creatures deals damage equal to its power to Pelucranos. We've told many stories about Pelucranos, particularly in the first 100 or so episodes of our podcast, many different stories about repeated judge calls where judges got things wrong about how this card operated, appeals to various levels, not wagers, of course, but friendly gentleman discussions about how this card functioned, being escalated to various levels. But the reason I've selected it this week is actually just more of a kind of reminder of what a reasonably powerful 4-mana threat in a ramp strategy could look like if Wizards of the Coast is interested in designing such a card in the future. You know, you'll notice that this is a card that when you play it, it doesn't immediately do anything. And then when you activate it, there's multiple opportunities for counterplay. And then it does kill a bunch of your opponent's stuff. But even then, it's limited. It requires you to pump a bunch more mana into it for it to be really, really sick. So this is the kind of card where, you know, maybe is quite a bit of value for 4 mana, but I feel like is maybe 20% as much as certain recent unnamed 4-mana cards that go in ramp decks. So this is probably a healthier place to aim for next time.
Pelucranos was one of my favorite cards in that, like, set format.
Yeah.
It wasn't particularly good, but I really did enjoy playing it in the monster just decks. Like, I don't know. I think it was a very fun card.
I think it was good. I think it was very... I thought it landed in a great spot.
Yeah,
like you said,
liked
it
how
was
it
very powerful with a lot of places for counterplay.
Yeah, I liked the Pelucranos against Tidebinder Mage, like paradigm in particular, because Tidebinder Mage was like a main deck card at the time, thanks to Mono Blue Devotion, and was pretty good typically at beating up on some of the red green monster creature decks. But Pelucranos was then really good against Tidebinder Mage specifically, because even if you tapped it, it could still just kill it for 5 mana, and that was like kind of a natural curve. So I really like that.
Yeah, I think that worked out very nicely. All right, let's move on to our main topic. Our main topic this week is the 2020 season grand finals, which we've already covered. Much of the discussion that was going to happen in this bit, due to my incompetence, we've already discussed the intentional draws situation and everything. I think we've covered pretty much everything that we wanted to do in that space. We've already discussed which cards got banned, and a little bit of what standard is going to look like from here. We'll talk maybe a little bit more about where standard's going if we want at the end of this. But first, let's start by rewinding to the tournament itself. Benjamin, you described your tournament as a very mediocre one. What was kind of the story of the tournament from the good players in it?
Well, I mean, pretty much everyone was playing various, like, Omnath in some format. Like, either historic or standard. Pretty much everybody had at least four Omnaths registered. So I think the story of the tournament was how busted that card was, basically. Almost everyone showed up with Omnath Adventures in Standard. There were some notable exceptions. Emma and Autumn showed up with a Gruul Adventures deck, which was mostly, I think, relying on Ember Cleave to kill their opponent quickly. And Seth showed up with like a rogues deck. Not a rogue deck, but a rogues
I believe both are appropriate.
I would describe it as a rogue deck, because even among the like known rogues deck, it was very different.
Yeah, he made some interesting innovations. So a lot of rogues deck had like an into the story sideboard plan where they would become like a blue-black control deck. Seth basically put that in the main deck and just put Luris as his companion. Luris is an exceedingly powerful card, and the rogue like two mana spells are actually quite good. Like 3/2 flash death touch for one mana is pretty strong. And Soaring Thought Thief and Vantress Gargoyle are also pretty powerful, pretty strong two drops. So I actually really liked Seth's build. I thought the Luris innovation was really smart. And he kind of showed it, like a lot of his games were won by him like playing protect the companion basically by sticking a Luris and then like countering his opponent's stomps or like few ways to remove it or whatever, and then sort of riding that to victory. I think his deck has a little bit of an issue with early Clovers, which is I think how he fell in the elimination rounds. But I don't know, I thought that was a really cool deck. The Gruul Adventures deck I think was mostly trying to capitalize on people arms racing for the mirror. Like people were cutting Brazen Borrowers and people were cutting Lovestruck Beasts. And those are the kind of cards that are really good against like a red-green strategy. So I think that's what they were trying to exploit.
Yeah, and that new elemental in red-green looked really strong to me. Like just the fact that it was often a 5/5 attacking with haste to put Embercleave on looked pretty powerful.
Yeah, I think that card is quite good. It's a great mutate target. It's a 1/1 for Lovestruck Beast sometimes, like... Yeah, I think that card is just quite good. Yeah, I was I was a little bummed after I saw the deck list because I felt like my standard deck was fine, but it was just the same as everybody else's, like nothing really special.
Would you have changed anything about it, or would you change anything about it if you got to go back?
Yeah, I would. I think knowing how many rogues decks were in the field, I would cut the Chainweb Arachnears. We were expecting a little more of those because also Chainweb Arachnir is just super, super hard for them to beat. So it's a pretty good sideboard card. At some point during testing, we decided that Embercleave was better than Fling. But after I played in the tournament, I think it was pretty clearly not. I just had a lot of spots where Fling not having to attack with the Beanstalk Giant made like a pretty big difference.
Oh, dude, Flings were... I forgot who it was, but somebody was popping off with Flings in the top eight.
Well, there was just a very, very close match between Austin and Nassif where, like, Austin was able to steal the match with Fling. And Austin played very well and played to his outs to identify what he needed to do. Nassif kind of threw the game in that he did not identify that was basically the only way that he could lose and sort of screwed up his sequencing and also played a little too defensively at a key moment. Like there was a turn where he wished for Embercleave where he should have just played Beanstalk Giant. And then on the next turn, if he wishes for Embercleave and the Beanstalk Giant can attack, he'll just win the game. But as it was, he was one turn too slow.
Yeah. I remember seeing some discussion on Twitter about that line. I feel like it was likely to be a case of the, like you were talking about identifying the Fling as the card that was going to beat you?
Yeah, I mean, it's weird because a lot of the discussion on Twitter was like, oh, like, you know, this is why you play Fling. This is, like, the other deck is better constructed. And I do think that Fling is better, but pointing to this game is not great because I think that Nassif could have won fairly easily, like, without Fling. Even with Austin having Fling. It's kind of weird when you see all this discussion on Twitter, but you're just like, I really don't think that's not the lesson that we should take away from this game. But I don't know. I don't want to rain on anyone's parade for like, or excitement for watching the match, you know?
How about the historic portion of the tournament? Did you have any insights or regrets about how your deck choice went for that?
I mean, our deck just wasn't very well positioned. I played against Omneth Ramp twice. I beat it once. I lost to it once. I felt like I got pretty lucky to beat it once. So, Yeah. Like I played against that twice, the mirror three times, I think. And then Jund Food once. Our deck was just very bad. I wish I could have. Or poorly positioned, I would say. But I guess I wish we would have worked on Omnath a little more. We tried it and gave up on it pretty quickly. I don't quite remember why, but it seems pretty clearly a mistake in hindsight.
All right, Sam, do you have any interview questions for Benjamin and/or any thoughts of your own about the 2020 season grand finals?
So one thing I noticed watching the tournament was the number of options players had available to them in standard in particular was so outrageous. I was surprised that more games actually didn't come down to time because like there were just multiple spots where I believe players had, five cards in hand and then three cards on an adventure and a fully resolved Escape to the Wild that was mostly spells or whatever. It just seemed insane and mind-boggling to me. And I had played the Adventures deck a little bit. Like I played it in the CFB Clash event, and I did not play very well. I didn't try to play very well. I just kind of did stuff, and it still felt like I had way too many options and way too many things to do every turn. And imagining trying to actually like find the optimal line as opposed to just sort of finding go like going by my heuristics and finding the good enough lines sounded like a miserable experience. Is that how you felt, Ben?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think I was really faced with too much paralysis, but like my main problem with the experience was that the mirrors are just very uninteractive because you can like stop each other to a very small amount, but usually it's just you're trying to put as many lands into play as fast as possible so that you can cast as many spells as fast as possible because you just have so many spells to cast, like you said. So it's just not interesting because you can't really stop your opponent. Like you don't have enough interactive tools to really stop your opponent from putting a bunch of lands into play. So it's better to just like go as fast, like race them, basically. I will say that like quite a number of games went to time. So I lost to Raph when Raph had 20 seconds left on his clock. Yvonne timed out. When we played, we finished game two and he had 15 seconds left. And so he just conceded game three because he couldn't possibly win. And I know that Yvonne beat Sam Sherman with like 20 seconds left on his clock, also. So, like, it definitely happened. Like, the mirrors can be pretty long because everyone just has so very many spells to cast.
One of my
Yeah,
favorite things
it's
about the
problematic.
one of my favorite things about the tournaments going online though is that there's no longer this kind of like you're no longer like if you need to take a minute to think about your turn, you're no longer like stealing equity from your opponent, right? And you no longer have to like police them to see like it's
Yeah,
like you were talking about earlier in response to our Patreon question, Sam, where like the fact that there's that chess clock there is just such a such a neutral good arbiter. Dividing that time up equally for everybody to think that you neither have to police yourself or your opponents on it anymore. And also, it means that players no longer have this incentive to spend 10 minutes on a decision because, the options are, okay, we go to a draw or I win because I thought better, right? Like you now have a much more real cost to tanking, for 80% of the match.
Yeah,
I think
I agree. I
the
like
rope
that.
is really, really good for play. Like, it is much shorter than the typical amount of time a player would think in like a paper feature match, which I think is good.
Yeah, the paper feature matches, even not even just feature matches, but just like in the tournament, you just have these like 3 minute periods of a player just kind of not even realizing there's a problem and just like shuffling their cards around. So yeah, I think that's one of the most exciting things about digital tournaments versus paper.
Yeah, and I actually like that the rope enforces a play per turn speed in addition to the overall chess clock. Like I've definitely heard some arguments against the rope saying that you should that once you have a chess clock you don't need it. But I think games are just kind of boring when people spend a really long time not taking a game action, and it's a
Yeah.
lot more fun to have things keep progressing.
Yeah, I agree. I like the rope.
All right. Well, that has been our main topic this week. Thank you, Benjamin, for your wonderful reporting on this tournament. Would you like to now tell us an end story?
Sure. So we, in my household, we buy a lot of, flavored water, like LaCroix and whatnot, because I drink a lot of it. So one day I go to the refrigerator and I pick up a can and I'm just like, there's something wrong with this can. Like, what the heck? So I pick up a different can and I'm trying to figure out if one of them weighs less than the other. And like, I switch them between my arms like multiple times to just try to figure things out. Cause like, I'm worried that like my muscles are atrophying, right? Like I'm worried like, oh my God, like is my left arm just like much, much stronger than my right arm?
Wait, hold on. That's the first thing you think of when you pick up something that weighs the wrong amount?
Right. My right arm being much, much stronger than my left arm is actually what I was thinking of.
But that's the first place you go, not this clearly weighs the wrong amount.
Well, it's a can. Why would it be the wrong amount? But that's what I'm worried about, right? Like, so I give them to my roommate, and my roommate is like, yeah, these definitely weigh the same amount. And so I'm just like, what the hell is going on with me? Like, I'm really worried that one of my arms is like has gotten like freakishly weak or something like that. But luckily, I remember that we live in a household of three. So I asked Jenny to check as well. And Jenny's just like, oh, yeah, this definitely weighs less. Who the hell told you it weighed the same? And so finally, like, we make fun of Sam for not being able to tell. And then I propose a game where, all right, we're going to put the next person to take the light one out of the fridge. They don't get to put it back. They just, they're locked in for half as much as they wanted.
What, then, was like, it really half as full?
Yeah, what happened? Like, was it opened Was it opened in some way? Like, how did it...
No, it was sealed. It just had half the water in it.
I wouldn't drink that. I would be nervous that something bad had happened to it.
My guess is probably just like one in a million or one in 10,000 cans that's like at the end of the production line for the day or whatever. Just gets the half fill.
Yeah, that was
and then also sneaks through QA.
I didn't think it was like unsafe. I just was like, well, this is weird. Anyway, like 2 days later, I obviously was the one who picked up the can and was like, God damn it. So then I had to drink it. And as far as I'm aware, I haven't died yet, so.
That is gonna be all for us this week. We'll unite again next week for more Ally Strategies.
Was that our shortest main topic of all time?
Well, if you consider that it was interspersed throughout the episode, no.
I wasn't considering that. I meant from the time you said, and now to our main topic.
Now to our main topic?
To end story.
I would say it was probably competitive. We've had some short ones in the past.
That was probably like 10 minutes.
I think it was 15 or 20 or something. Yeah, maybe it was our shortest of all time. There was that one week where we didn't get to our main topic due to the filibuster.
Well, that's different. That's no main topic. That's not short main topic.
We just hadn't even gotten in this.
Oh, dude, we forgot to do Will the Council. Oh. We need to do Will the Council soon.
We can do that next week.
Yeah, I'll put that in. I'll put that in the...
That's great.
We just hadn't even gotten into the illustrious friends yet, and Tristan's just already talking about intentional draws, and I'm just like, what the heck, dude?
Well, I don't know. We'll see. We'll solicit some listener feedback and see what they think about the...
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously I saved it by making fun of you for it.